We're at the bottom of Pei Zayin of Beis, the third last word on the line, where it says, Amar Rav Papa. The Mishnah taught that if a woman comes to collect her ksuba, but the husband produces a single witness who testifies that her ksuba was already paid, the halacha is that in order for her to collect the ksuba, she would have to first swear against the Eidecha that she did not receive her ksuba yet. Now, there is a case of a biblical requirement to swear against a single witness. But the Gemara explained that the case under discussion is not an application of that biblical requirement. Because first of all, the case where there's a biblical requirement to swear involves a single witness who testifies that a person owes money. Torah says that the person must either swear, it's not true, I don't owe this money, or pay. That is, the Torah imposes an oath in order for a person to avoid payment, whereas in our case, the opposite. The Mishnah is saying that the woman swears against the Eidecha in order to collect payment of the ksuba. In addition, a collection of a ksuba, by definition, involves encumbered land. Halach is that the ksuba creates a lien on the husband's land. The halach is that in terms of the biblical oath to swear against a single witness, one is exempt from having to take that oath if the dispute involves land. Rather, the Gemara concluded, the oath that our Mishnah teaches is a rabbinic oath. The Rabbanan said that since there's this single witness who has testified that she's not owed the ksuba, even though, of course, anything short of two witnesses in court can't actually establish anything in the court, the Rabbanan decreed that she must first swear against the Eidecha before she may collect her ksuba. Now, what's the difference whether the oath is rabbinic or biblical? Rashi here in Peches explains that the rabbinic shvua is less scary than a biblical shvua. The rabbinic shvua, the person swears and accepts, if it's not true, then there will be a curse. Whereas a biblical oath involves grasping something like a Sefer Torah, and she makes a shvua with Hashem's name. And so the prospect of taking a biblical oath is much more likely to motivate the defendant to admit rather than take the oath. The Rebbe begins by offering some advice for the husband in our case. And we're working on the assumption that in reality, she was already paid the ksuba. It happened before a single witness, but she claims that she wasn't paid, and she is now willing to take the rabbinic oath against a single witness to be able to collect the ksuba again. Rav Papa offers the husband some advice. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa said, continuing to Peches Amud Aleph, I pikeachu, if this husband is clever, maisi lali de shvua de araisa, he will use the following strategy to bring her to a requirement to take a biblical oath. And that is, yohiv lo ksubasa ba peichat zahada. He should make sure that once she takes the rabbinic oath, and he pays the ksuba a second time, to do that in the presence of a witness. And so now you have the original witness, who witnessed the husband paying her a ksuba, and this second witness, who witnessed the husband paying her a ksuba on a separate occasion. Misamech sahada kama sahada basra. And he can now combine the testimonies of the two witnesses. He now has two witnesses, who each are able to testify, yeah, he paid her a ksuba. So, of course, at this point, she can't attempt another collection. We have two witnesses who can testify she was already paid her ksuba. But then the husband should go further. He should now submit his claim to the court that he was unlawfully made to pay his wife's ksuba twice. And should she respond, that's not true, that most recent payment was the only time he paid her ksuba, the husband will bring forward the original witness who will testify regarding the previous payment. And so the husband will argue to the court that since she has admitted to having accepted this recent payment for her ksuba, we should now regard the previous payment as a debt that she owes to me. Now, of course, there's only one witness that previous payment occurred, but the testimony of that single witness will have the effect of requiring her to take a biblical oath with the Sefer Torah, with Hashem's name, in order to not have to pay, since this dispute meets the criteria for the requirement of a biblical oath. First of all, it's a defensive oath. He's telling her, you owe me money. I gave you this whole extra payment. So it's an oath for her to avoid payment. And also, since it's not a dispute about whether she's Odik Suba, it doesn't implicate the rule that says that no biblical oath applies where it's a dispute about type of debt that encumbers land. This is just a regular loan. He's saying, I gave her some money, and she now owes me that money back. She therefore will have to take a biblical oath if she wants to claim she never received that money and not pay. But the Gemara points out a problem with this strategy. Maskif lo Rav Shisha b'rei de Rav Idi. He points out that critical to this strategy is having the force of two witnesses who establish that she was already paid her ksuba. The problem is that while in total the two witnesses are able to testify about a payment, heyach samich sahad de kama asahad de basra. How can we combine them, considering the fact that they're not testifying to the same event? So if Shisha Rav Yehuda argues, it's not valid to say, I have two witnesses who've established that she was paid her ksuba. No, we don't. There's one witness who tells us she was paid a ksuba on a certain date, another witness who testifies she was paid a ksuba on a different date. They do not combine, and therefore, should she claim I wasn't paid anything whatsoever, she would be given the option of taking the rabbinic oath and collecting a third time. So that certainly would not be a good strategy for the husband. So the Gemara presents an improved version of the strategy. Ella Amar Rav Shisha Berei Derav Idi says, here's what he should do. Yayiv lo ksubasa ba'ape sahadakama v'sahadabasra. The husband should see to it that when he makes the second ksuba payment, he should do so in the presence of both the original witness, the one who witnessed the first payment, plus another witness. And so that will indisputably establish, she won't be able to deny that she was paid her ksuba, and he'll then proceed to reclaim in court. He says, look, I paid her another time previously, so that should be deemed a loan. She should now owe me that money. And of course, there's a one witness to back that claim up, and that will force her to respond by either paying the money, no confessing, or taking a biblical oath. But the Gemara finds a problem with this strategy as well. Maskev lo Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi points out, Akati yachola lemeimar shtei ksubos avai. Even with this strategy, she would be able to evade having to take any biblical oath by claiming that, yes, my husband made two payments because he agreed to pay me two ksubos. Now, certainly that would be unusual, and we wouldn't normally consider such a claim as credible. But here, her claim is actually supported by the fact that the witness who witnessed both payments will confirm that, yeah, both times it was for her ksuba. The Gemara answers, Ella Amar Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi adds one more step that needs to be taken in this strategy, which is Hu Demoda Lahu. You must make sure, before the second payment is made, to notify the witnesses as to what's going on. You should tell them that this whole thing is fraudulent. I already paid her ksuba, but only, you know, one of you was my witness previously, so I'm going to make the payment again, this time in front of the two of you, but not because I owe her a second ksuba. Rather, I'm doing this so that I'll be able to impose a biblical oath on her in the hopes that this will motivate her to confess that she unlawfully collected the ksuba twice. And so by doing this, of course, should she make the claim that really owes her two ksubos, the information held by the witnesses will no longer support that claim, being that that would be most unusual for him to agree to pay her two ksubos. We won't find that claim to be credible at all. Rather, the only way for her to avoid payment would be by taking a biblical oath. The Mishnah stated that if a woman comes to collect her ksuba from minechasim mishubadim, from land that her husband had sold, and so she is utilizing the lien of the ksuba to seize that property as payment for the ksuba, or if she's collecting her ksuba from orphans, her husband had passed away, left the estate to his orphans, she's now collecting her ksuba from the estate, from the orphans. In both of these cases, she would have to first take a shavua that she was not already paid the ksuba. The Gemara cites in Mishnah Masechta Shavuos, which teaches a related halacha. To Nanhasim, we learn in the Mishnah there, in Shavuos, the Mishnah there states that just as before one may collect from orphans for a debt that their father owed, the creditor must first take a shavua that he wasn't already paid. The orphans themselves, if they are attempting to collect a debt that was owed to their father, they would first have to swear that to the best of their knowledge, the loan wasn't already paid. The Gemara asks, Miman, what's the case here? From whom are they collecting this loan exactly? Ilema milove. If the case is they're collecting from the borrower himself, that wouldn't make any sense. For hashta avien shakel below shvua ve'inu b'shvua. Their father, if he were collecting, wouldn't have to swear in such a case if he was collecting from the borrower himself. And what, we're going to be more strict with the orphans and impose a requirement on them to swear? On the contrary, the Rabbanan always take measures to try and be more lenient on the orphans if they're litigating the case. So that cannot be what the Mishnah means, where it explains, Ela hachi kamar. Rather, the Mishnah is saying as follows. V'chein ha-yesomim min ha-yesomim lo yiparu ela b'shvua. Just as their father would have had to swear were he collecting from orphans, the orphans themselves, if they're collecting their father's debt from orphans, meaning where the borrower is no longer alive, so he's collecting from his orphans, the orphans of the creditor themselves will have to first swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't already paid. The Gemara teaches a distinction with regards to this halacha. Amar Rav Zirika, Amar Rav Yehuda. He said, Lo shanu ela shamru yesomim, amar lanu abba lavisi o parati. He says, we only allow the lender's orphans to swear and then collect, where the other side, the borrower's orphans, conceded, yes, our father told us that he borrowed this money, but he told us that he paid the money already. Since all parties agree that this loan occurred, the only question is, was it paid already? The halacha is, the lender's orphans swear that to the best of their knowledge, the loan was not paid up, and they then collect. Avalamru, omrlanuwa, balolavisi. But where the borrower's orphans claim that our father told us he never borrowed this money whatsoever, af bishvua lo yiparu. In that case, even if the lender's orphans were to swear, no, it's not true, he did borrow this money, he owes us this money, they would not be able to collect. The Gemara emphatically rejects this distinction. Maskev la Rava. Rava challenged this, saying, Adarabba. On the contrary, kolo omra lo lavisi, ka omra lo parati dami. If somebody submits the claim, I never borrowed this money, well, included in that claim, obviously, is the concession that if the loan does exist, he never paid that loan back. He's saying, I never borrowed the money. If we find out he did borrow the money, he has admitted that he never paid it back. Meanwhile, the lender's orphans have a signed authenticated document which states that, in fact, the orphan's father did borrow this money. And so, if anything, the counterclaim of our father never borrowed this money only makes the case of the lender's orphan stronger. The Gemara therefore concludes, Aliyidmar Hachi Idmar. Here is what must have been stated. Amrav Zerika, Amrav Yehuda. Zerika said in the name of Rav Yehuda, Lo shonu ela sha'omru yisom amrlanu abalavisi uparati. The Mishnah's ruling that says the lender's orphans must first swear and then they could collect only applies where the borrower's orphans made the claim that our father did tell us he borrowed this money, but he told us he paid it back. And the truth is, even if they didn't specifically submit such a claim, let's say they're minors, there's a concept called taininan, which means the bezdin will submit that claim on their behalf, meaning we will acknowledge, yes, there's a loan here, but we have this document that says there was a loan, but we submit on behalf of these orphans that their father paid back the money, and that will require the lender's orphans to swear before collecting that, to the best of their knowledge, the loan wasn't paid back. Avalomru amrlanu abba lo lavisi. But if the borrower's orphan said that our father told us, I never borrowed this money whatsoever, Allah is nifrain shalo bishvua, it would permit the lender's orphans to collect the money without even having to first swear. Shakol ha'omr lo lavisi ka omr lo parati dami. Because of the point we made above, if a person says the words, I never borrowed this money, well, included in that statement is, I never paid it back. He's saying there was no loan to pay back. Meanwhile, it's established in Bezdin definitively that there was a loan because there's a signed document to that effect. So since there's no longer any issue to litigate, the other side admitted they didn't pay the loan back, we would permit the orphans' lenders to simply collect the loan without first having to swear. The Mishnah stated further, V'nifras shelo befanav lo tipara ela b'shvua. If a woman came to collect her ksuba in her husband's absence, she would have to first swear that she wasn't already paid the ksuba. This clearly implies that we will allow her to collect her ksuba even if her husband isn't here in the court, let's say he sent her a get from overseas, we would allow her to collect ksuba from the husband's estate, even in his absence. The word discusses whether we would allow such a thing in the case of a collection of an ordinary loan, where it says, Amravacha sar habira, maisa balifner bi Yitzchak beantochia. When this question came before bi Yitzchak and Antochia, there was a regular creditor who wanted to collect from his debtor's estate in the debtor's absence. Yamar, and he ruled, Lo shonu elak subas isha mishum chinam. This was only permitted by the Rabbanan, the case of a woman collecting her ksuba to make a marriage appealing to women. I mean, we don't want to make too many barriers, make it difficult for women to actually collect her ksuba, for this might discourage them from getting married. And so she could collect in her husband's absence after swearing that she wasn't paid already. Aval b'chov lo, if we're talking about an ordinary creditor, someone borrowed money from him and now he wants to collect, seize from that person's assets in his absence, that we do not allow. Rather, the debtor has a right to be here so that he can litigate the case and perhaps represent a claim why he doesn't owe this money. However, v'rava omer av nachman afilu b'chov, he says even an ordinary creditor will be allowed to see his assets from the debtor. And if he has the shtar, it says, this person owes some money, he will allow him to seize something from the debtor as a payment for the debt, even in the debtor's absence. Shelo yehe kol echad ve'echad notum osav shel chaveiro v'holech v'yoshev medina sayam v'atano delas b'fnei lovin, to prevent a situation in which borrowers take advantage by borrowing a bunch of money and then skipping town, knowing that they're protected, the Bezdin won't allow a seizure of their assets in their absence, and that will have a chilling effect on the economy, meaning lenders won't want to lend money, knowing that they're at such a disadvantage. And so an ordinary creditor as well could see his assets from his debtor even in his debtor's absence. Our Mishnah presented numerous rulings having to do with whether a woman is required to swear before collecting her ksuba. And the Mishnah then concludes with Rabbi Shimon Omer. Rabbi Shimon says, "Calls mancha tovas ksubasa." Whenever she makes a claim for her ksuba, the text in the Mishnah continues, "Hayarshim mashabinasa." The heir she's collecting from can require her to swear that she wasn't already paid. Rabbi Shimon then states, "Im ena tovas ksubasa." If she's not making a claim for her ksuba, ena yarshim mashabinasa, and the heir she's collecting from cannot require her to swear. The Gemara asked Rabbi Shimon, Ahai, of the numerous rulings previously presented in the Mishnah, which of them is Rabbi Shimon referring to? And what is Rabbi Shimon coming to say? Where it suggests an interpretation of Rabbi Shimon, Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Aha. Rabbi Shimon's statement is directed at the immediately preceding ruling that said, V'nifras shelo b'fanav lo tipora ela b'shvua. First opinion of the Mishnah states, that a woman coming to collect from her husband's estate in his absence must first swear. Now this statement implies loshna lemizoni veloshna leksuba, that whether we are discussing the actual ksuba payment or the associated payments of the ksuba of mizonos, she's coming to collect support money from the estate. The first opinion of the Mishnah holds that before she can collect that money as well, she must first swear that her husband didn't already leave her support money. V'yasa Rabbi Shimon l'meimar, Rabbi Shimon comes to say, calls mancha tevas ksubasa yarshe mashbinasa. When she comes to collect her ksuba from the estate, her husband's family can require her to swear. She wasn't paid for that already. However, turning to Amid Beis, eina tovas ksubasa, Rabbi Shimon says if she's not coming to collect her ksuba, but rather mizonos money, ein yarshe mashbinasa. Her husband's side cannot require her to swear before collecting that. The Gemara explains, V'kemiflagi v'plukta dechonan u'b'nei kohanim gedolim. Rabbi Shimon and Tadakama of our Mishnah thus take different sides of the Tanaic dispute between Chanan and the b'nei kohanim gedolim. The Tanan, as is taught in the Mishnah later, in our Masechta Kufdalit Amid Beis, Mishnah there states, Mishahalach l'medina sayam v'ishta tavas mizonos. The husband went away, and the wife comes to claim from his family money from the estate for her support she's entitled to. Does she have to first swear? Chanan omer tishava basof v'lo tishava batchila. She'll swear later when ultimately she comes to collect her ksuba. You know, at that point, she'll swear that her husband didn't leave her money that we're not aware of, and that will cover whether that's your money for her ksuba or her mizonos. And so since that will all be covered eventually at the end, we don't require her to, at the beginning, right now, make her swear before she can collect money for her mizonos. So that's Chanan's opinion. However, Nechleku Allah b'nei Kohanim Gedolim v'amru, the b'nei Kohanim Gedolim argue with this, and said, no, tishava batchila ubasov. We require her to swear later when she collects her ksuba, and to swear now when she is coming to collect her mizonos. Answer, Rishimin kechanan, Rabbanan k'b'nei Kohanim Gedolim, the proposal is, Rabbi Shimon of our Mishnah agrees with Chanan that she's not required to swear for a claim for mizonos from the estate, whereas the Rabbanan of our Mishnah, Tanakama, agrees with B'nei Kohanim Gedolim that she is required to swear even before she may collect for mizonos. The Gemara takes issue with this approach. Maskev Lo Rav Sheshes points out, Ha Yorshin Mashbinosa. Problems, if this is what Rabbi Shimon is really coming to say in our Mishnah, why does he speak about the question of whether her husband's heirs can require her to swear before collecting? Why bezdim hashbino sami baile? For Rabbi Shimon here is to take sides in the dispute between Chanan and B'nei Kohanim Gedolim, then we shouldn't be discussing whether the heirs can require her to swear, but whether bezdin would impose such a requirement. After all, that's the case that Chanan and B'nei Kohanim Gedolim discuss. The husband is alive and well, he's just overseas. The question is, she wants to collect the mizonos in her husband's absence, does she have to swear first? So the interpretation doesn't fit with this language of Yorshin, which implies that we're specifically talking about something that would be litigated after her husband has passed away. And so Elam, Rav Sheshes, ever suggests a different approach. He says, Rabbi Shimon's words are directed, to the halacha that was stated in the previous Mishnah, on Pevav Amabez, the Mishnah there taught that if a husband had made his wife an apotropos, a manager of his estate, he could at any time he wants, even without any kind of definite claim, require her to swear that she didn't embezzle anything. His heirs as well could require her to take such an oath. The Mishnah further teaches the husband could exempt her from having to be subject to such an oath. He could say that no such oath will apply to you, whether that's coming from me or my heirs. And then they wouldn't be able to force her to take the Shavuah of Apotropos, swear that as a manager she didn't embezzle anything. The Mishnah there says, in such a case, where her husband had exempted her from having to swear either to him or his heirs as Apotropos of the estate, if Halcha Mikevra Bala Lebeis Aviha, if upon her husband's passing, she moved immediately back to her father's home, Oshe Chazra Lebeis Chamia Velanasis Apotropia, or even if she remained in her husband's home, but if she ceased serving as Apotropos, as administering the estate, Eina Yarshim Mashbinosa, the heirs in either of these cases would not be able to force her to swear that she didn't embezzle anything, even during the time when she was serving as Apotropos of the estate. The Mishnah then says, "Vimnasis apotropia." But if she continued to serve as manager of the estate after her husband's passing, Yorshin Mashbin Osal Ha'asid Lavo Fein Mashbin Osal Masha Avar. The heirs could require her to swear that she didn't embezzle anything, but only beginning from her tenure as apotropia, when the estate was in the hands of the heirs. For it is only at that point that the husband's a declaration of exemption for any oath loses its hold, because now the estate belongs to the heirs. She has a new employer. So says the first opinion of the Mishnah, Asa Rabbi Shimon Lameimar. Shimon in our Mishnah comes to say that not only calls Mancha Tovas Ksubasa Yorshim Hashbinosa, only if she is coming to collect her Ksuba may the heirs require her to first swear. Of course, that's the halacha. If she wants to collect her Ksuba, she must swear first that she wasn't paid the ksuba already. However, Eina Tovas Ksubasa, she's not coming to collect her ksuba from the heirs, but rather it's a question of whether the heirs could require her to swear that she didn't embezzle anything since she began to serve as a petropia of the estate once that was in their possession after they had inherited it. Shimon says, Eina Yarshim Hashbinasa, her heirs cannot arbitrarily say, okay, we want you to swear you didn't embezzle anything. Now that, of course, requires explanation. The standard halacha of apotropis is that he could be made to swear by his employer. The Gemara explains, v'kimiflugi v'plukta de abishol v'rabbanon. According to this approach, Rabbi Shimon and Tanakhama of our Mishnah are taking different sides of a dispute between Abishol and the Rabbanon, the Tanan. This dispute is related in the Mishnah, Masechtas Gittin. The Mishnah there states the following, Apotropis sheminohu avi yisomim yishava. A manager of an orphan's estate that was appointed by their father can be compelled to swear that he did not embezzle anything, which is the standard halacha. But minu bezdin lo yishava. A court-appointed manager of an estate belonging to orphans cannot be compelled to swear they didn't embezzle anything. The Gemara in Gittin explains that the rationale of the first opinion, the Rabbanan, is that if we would require a court-appointed manager to take this oath, it would deter people from volunteering to serve in that role, to agree to be apotropis, to say, oh, you're going to suspect me, you're going to make me swear and embezzle anything. Thanks, but no thanks, I'm not going to take the job. We want people to offer to serve as apotropis to help the Yisomim, and so we give them the benefit that we're not going to require you to swear, and we'll vet the person, hopefully he's trustworthy. We won't make the person swear if the Yisomim say, we suspect embezzlement, we won't require him to swear. We're not worried, by contrast, that if the father himself appointed the guardian, that an oath requirement would deter him from serving that capacity, because presumably if he agreed to this, it was because the father had done some favor for him. He obviously feels beholden to the family, so he's willing to do this. The fact that he'll have to swear won't scare him away. But Abishol Omer Chilaf Adram. Abishol said just the opposite. Minu Bezdin Yishava. A court-appointed manager must take the oath, whereas we know Avi Yisomim Lo Yishava. The father had appointed him, that he's exempt from the oath. Abishol's rationale is that in the case of a court-appointed manager, the downside of the shvur requirement will be outweighed by the positive of the prestige it lends to him that he was appointed by the court to be apotropis of the estate. It's an honorable thing. So we're not worried that it'll be deterred from that job by the oath requirement. But if he's just doing a personal favor for the father, we are actually worried about that. He doesn't enjoy any honor by being put in that position just as a personal favor for this person who passed away. If he's told you're going to have to swear this shvuz of apotropis, he might flee. Now, presumably, the widow in our Mishnah's case was not appointed by the court to manage the estate. She was asked to do that by her late husband. And thus, Rabbi Shimon, who comes to exempt her from the manager's oath, concurs with Abishol. That again, if the manager was appointed by the deceased person himself, then that manager is exempt from the oath. Whereas the first opinion, the Rabbanan of our Mishnah, who are more stringent, who say that she does have to take the manager's oath, concur with the Rabbanan of the Mishnah there in Gittin. But Abaye takes issue with this approach, Maskif Law Abaye. Abaye points out, if Rav Sheshes is correct, that Rabbi Shimon in our Mishnah is coming to argue for a more lenient position than Tanakhama. Again, Tanakhama was saying she has to take the manager's oath. She continues to work as the manager for the orphans. Rav Sheshes is suggesting that Rav Shimon comes to say no, even as manager of the orphans' estate, she need not take the manager's oath. Problem is, Haikol's man shetovas ksubasa, Rav Shimon's words in the Mishnah are that Kol's man, as long as, whenever we're dealing with a case where she's trying to collect her ksuba, then she has to swear. If Rav Shimon's purpose here is not to expand the oath requirement, but to limit it, im tovas mi boile. He ought to have said, if she's coming to collect her ksuba, then she has to swear. Then that would fit with Rav Sheshes' approach, that his point is to say, but otherwise, if they're trying to impose a different shvua, a manager's shvua, she would not have to take that oath. That's not what Rabbi Shimon says. Rabbi Shimon's language indicates that it's coming to be more stringent than the Tanakhama. Say that there's some case that Tanakhama said she doesn't have to swear. I say that she does have to swear. So it's back to the drawing board. The Gemara says, Ella Amar Abaye. Rather, Abaye explained that Rabbi Shimon's statement here comes to disagree, aha, with a different teaching, found earlier in the Mishnah, on Pevav of Bebeis, where the Mishnah states, Kosav la neder ushvua eli alayech. The husband disclaimed any right to require her to swear, Eino yochel lashbia, and he indeed would not be able to force her to swear. However, his heirs would be able to compel her to swear. Also, an oath requirement could be imposed on her heirs. The Mishnah said, if the husband declared, Neder ushvua ein li velo li yarshai velo labayim birshusi, I can't impose any shvua requirements, not me nor my heirs, alayach val yarshayach val labayim birshuseich, upon you or your heirs. If he made such a declaration, ein yachol lashbia lo hu velo yarsha velo labayim birshusa lo hi velo yarsha velo labayim birshusa. Indeed, he or his heirs would not be able to impose an oath requirement on her nor her heirs. And so that means if, for example, the husband died and so she came to collect ksuba from the estate of the orphans, she wouldn't be required to swear. V'yasa Rabbi Shimon Lemeimer, Rabbi explains, Rabbi Shimon, our Mishnah comes to disagree with this. It comes to say, Kol zman shetavas ksubasa yarshim mashbinasa. He says, no, whenever she comes to claim riksuba, the yarshim, the orphans, can require her to first swear. That is, even if the husband had explicitly tried to disclaim any ability to impose such a shvua upon his heirs, it doesn't work. It's not in the father's power to take away the orphan's rights to require her to swear before collecting the ksuba from them, to swear that she wasn't paid the ksuba already. Rabbi elaborates, V'kemiflugi b'plukta de'abishol ben ima Miriam v'rabana. Tanakam and Rabbi Shimon of our Mishnah are thus taking sides of the dispute that we saw on yesterday's daf between Abishol ben Ima Miriam and the Rabbanan. It is Rabbi Shimon ka Abishol. Rabbi Shimon sides with Abishol ben Ima Miriam, who says that such an attempt of the husband father to exempt her from the Shvua before collecting from the orphans fails. Berabbanan ka Rabbanan, whereas the Rabbanan, Tanakam of our Mishnah, would agree with the Rabbanan, the Mishnah, the opinion we just quoted, that you know, the husband is able to exempt his wife from the oath if he specifically said that even my yorshim, even the heirs, can impose the oath on you, then that is effective. But the Gemara points out this is not yet a complete explanation. Maskev lo rapapa points out, Hatinech kol zman shetavas ksubasa. While Abai's approach explains the first half of Rabbi Shimon's statement, then again, Rabbi Shimon says, whenever she comes to claim Riksuba from the orphans, she will have to swear. The husband's attempted exemption doesn't work. But what is Rabbi Shimon coming to say with the second half of his statement? Why does he add, if she's not coming to collect her ksuba, then she cannot be made to swear? Ella Rapub explains that with the second part of his statement, Rabbi Shimon comes Rabbi Eliezer Machlukaso to disagree with the very premise of the dispute found in the previous Mishnah. Higher up on the Amid, on Pevav and Mabez, the Mishnah there presented a dispute between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Eliezer as to the scope of the husband's ability to impose the manager's oath on his wife. The Rabbanan said if he specifically appointed her as manager of his assets, then he could at random require her to swear that she didn't embezzle anything. But Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah goes even further and says that even if the husband did not formally appoint his wife as a betrubis over his interests, he could still at random require her to swear to the integrity of the way that she manages the household. She automatically is obligated to manage the household, certain chores, so he could have her swear about that at random. Rapop explains that with the second half of his statement here, Rabbi Shimon comes to disagree with both of those tonight, and to say that a husband can never randomly require his wife to take a shvua, even if he appointed her manager over the estate. Halacha is that unless he has some kind of credible accusation, he can't just randomly require her to swear that she is managing the estate with integrity.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-9└ 7231.